really going up your nose, didn't it, eh?
What?
Him getting that job?
Some poxy job.
What do you know about jobs? Only job you ever had, you jacked it in after 5 minutes.
When was the last time you got off your arse and went down the job centre then, eh?
It's not my fault I ain't got no job.
Well, it ain't my fault I ain't got no job, right?
I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about him.
Well, shut up then.
Look at him. He ain't got much. As soon as he gets something, you've got to take it away from him.
Would you care anyway?
You what?
You don't give a monkeys about us.
Oh, that's rich, isn't it, eh? 20 years of clothing, your feet, your wiping your noses, wiping your arses.
What are you talking about? When do you ever wipe their arses?
I was the breadwinner, wasn't I? Comes down to the same thing.
It was never there.
All right, Joan of Arc. Thank you very much.
Shut up.
You shut up.
From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. You're hearing my voice. This is Stuart, so obviously there's no Hunter. And there's also no John, gone missing this week. Both of them, they've got things on, got the week off, they're tied up with some things. So I said I would grab the ship and steer it in the right direction somewhat. But I'm not doing it on my own, so don't worry. You don't have to hear me rattle on and think, oh, I've got to go listen to this fool. It's an all-Australian assault today. It's not another Ozplanation. It's actually a guy who's in the Facebook group there. Goes by the name of Julian Bulk, who's more commonly known as Jules, and also my younger brother. How you going, Jules?
How's it going? Very well, thank you.
All right. First MMC episode, first podcast ever.
Yep, 7 years into it, and here we are.
That's right.
Been a pleasure listening to all the episodes, and happy to join you for this one tonight.
Oh, very good. And we're actually here in my mini studio, if you will, with... the mics and the mixers, everything, and shit, these guys sound pretty clear, clearer than usual. It's because we're in the same room, in the theatre room in my house. Just watched a film that we're going to be talking about tonight. A film we've seen, what, maybe 50 times, got to be at least.
Oh, I must have seen this film at least 100 times, probably at least 10 times in the last month.
10 times in the last month?
Well, I got a recent copy of it, and I've just been watching it over and over,
yeah,
reliving it and enjoying it once again.
I remember that. Well, that film that we're talking about tonight is the 1984 television film, Meantime, a British film. If you haven't heard of it, you need to. If you have heard of it on this show, it's been spoken about before in the past in sporadic sort of conversations. Hunter and I did talk about it very early on, apparently in one of the first episodes back in 1974 when we first started this thing, and one that I haven't heard since it has been released. So I'd forgotten we had mentioned it, but... I remember you were telling me, Jules, that this film you played on a loop, basically.
Recently, yeah.
No, I remember you telling me a few years back you had, I don't know, the DVD of it or something.
It's one of those films I've been known to sort of put on and just play over and over again. And
yeah.
As a result, we've gotten quite used to all the lines in the film and which we tend to use in our daily, everyday lives.
You and I text each other pretty much on a daily basis.
It's it's one of those films where we use the lines in context with a lot of different things that happened in our lives and gives us a chuckle.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's one. Yeah, it's just you can even take a situation where you and I are out together, either just you and I or friends of ours with us, and we can just see something and throw a line from Meantime and just piss ourselves laughing for a few minutes afterwards.
Yeah, it's definitely got its sentimental value with us.
No, for sure. Hey, do you remember the first time we saw it?
Yeah, good question. I was just thinking about that today. If I'm not mistaken, I think you picked it up from a video store sometime in the 90s, I believe. Maybe in the mid-90s, was it?
No, it wasn't that late. Oh, no, it was about... I count it back to about... I want to say about 89, I reckon it was.
Okay, that long ago.
Yeah, it was quite a while.
Okay, anyway, I remember you picked it up and I think the what caught your eye was the cover. There was something about... It said Life on the Dole or something.
Yeah, that was a tag on it. It was a story about life on a doll, but it had the picture of Colin Pollock, played by Tim Roth, with an superimposed air bubble or speech bubble, text bubble that said, I'm not retarded, I'm just never been given a chance. I thought, this is too funny. So I think it might have been in the comedy section of the video store. And, I mean, this film is funny, but it is ultimately a drama.
Yeah, I mean, we see it in a completely sort of comical sense, but, I mean, if you break it down, there's a lot of darkness to the themes in the film.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. But originally we grabbed it for that cover, you know, and then we didn't realize it was going to become such a popular and important film in our sort of category, I suppose.
You didn't like it when you first watched it. I remember I brought it around. I said, oh, you're in one of your days where you're not having a good day. And I said, hey, Jules, you got to check this out. Check out the cover. You said, oh, what do I care?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, this film kind of grew on me, and I don't recall how many times it took before I started enjoying it, but after a while, I think I started finding that the lines funny, and it just sort of grew from there.
Yeah, it's probably because it's so based in real life that you can associate, you know, you and I haven't been on the dole before in the past as youngsters, you know, as our teenagers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you've been on the dole and if you've sort of grown up in a sort of working class area, you can sort of relate to this film. But if you come from a sort of middle class background and, you know, everything falls into place for you in life, then maybe you won't find this film quite so funny. But we can see a sort of funny side of the darker themes in it.
Yeah, you know, sitting around all day just watching TV and, you know, zero motivation to do anything and
playing pool. Yeah, just the whole dreariness of dole living, you know, the dole life.
Yeah, going in there and bloody, you know, handing your paperwork in every 2 weeks.
Yeah, the old visits to the dole office, yeah. So a lot of things in this film sort of, you know, struck home with us in many ways.
Yeah, it did. So, like, I remember the first time I watched it, I was expecting it to be just a complete ride of a film. But it wasn't that funny, and I think I was pretty much in the same boat as you. I liked it, but I didn't know what the hell to make of it. But it was one of those ones that I had to keep going back to it. I just kept seeing more and more of it. And we do it today. We saw it today. We saw more of it today when we were watching it, which we'll get to a part where what's etched on Colin's bedhead. I'd never seen it before in my life.
I thought it said Colin Pollock, but you pointed out it said Colin Rules.
Colin Rules, like R-O-O-L-Z.
Well, watching it on the big screen, you can pick things up more clearly. And we had, for the second half of the film, we put the subtitles on. Because there are a few lines in the film which we were, you know, sketchy about what they were saying, especially that West Indian guy.
Oh, good Lord, yeah.
Yeah, and Coxie, who plays the skinhead. Actually, just quickly, I saw this on YouTube recently. I was watching it on YouTube while I was somewhere. And the actual heading of it said meantime, and then it had in sort of brackets, it said London dialect, it said, which I thought was interesting.
And, okay.
Because it must have been from someone who posted it from overseas, a non-English person.
Right.
So if you actually, you know, I mean, because we grew up with a father who's from London, we find the actual dialogue quite...
it's easy for us.
Easy to pick up. I mean, a lot of the words, like the word Wally, you know, he says...
Yeah.
You know, calls Colin a Wally a lot, you know.
Yeah.
For us, that's, you know, we know that straight away what that means, but...
And also growing up watching British TV shows.
Well, that
and
is
movies,
well, yeah.
You know.
But for someone who's not... you know, from England or, you know, from Australia so much, you know, those words might be a bit foreign to them, so...
Yeah. I mean, you get, like, a lot of Americans wouldn't know the term wanker.
Yeah, well, even wanker, I mean, that's basic vocabulary for us, but, you know, terms like Wally and Pratt and...
Pratt, yeah.
Yeah, all those sort of words, you know, they're pretty common words for us.
Yeah, they are. But, yeah, so this film, it wasn't easy to get... I mean, it is available now. We'll bring it up later on where you can get it. I've got it.
Private joke there, folks.
Yeah, real private joke. Maybe become a soundboard clip sometime soon, I reckon. You can now get it via the Criterion Collection, but we'll bring it up later on towards the end there. I picked up on a DVD from the UK. I just got it in from the Amazon UK, and it was always only ever shown as a 1:33, 4:3 format because it was broadcast on television. In 84, filmed in 83, I believe it was, by Mike Lee. But the Criterion Collection actually brings it to its 1:66, which I never knew was filmed like. I always just thought it was filmed with television cameras. So that was a real delight to see that in its correct aspect ratio. I'd never seen it before in the many times that you and I had watched, never seen it like that. And while it didn't really give off a lot more information on the sides. Like, oh my God, look at that. There's something hidden away on the side there. It was just nice to see it as it was you know, shot. Now, you got some notes there, Jules. You were smart enough to take notes.
I watched it about two or three weeks ago, and I just thought I'd write down some of my favorite parts in the film, some of my favorite lines, and I thought I'd like to write them down just in case I forgot them. But I mean, there's many, many lines in this that we just find hysterical.
Let's run through the cast quickly.
Okay.
All right. So you got in there Tim Roth, very young Tim Roth.
See, this is the first film I'd seen with Tim Roth in it. I didn't know who he was, and then later on, when was it Reservoir Dogs?
Reservoir Dogs. Yeah.
That came out. I thought, oh, that's. What's his name from?
That's how I knew that you and I had not seen this in the mid '90s, because I actually saw Reservoir Dogs when it came out in '92.
Okay, well that's a good.
And point I knew him. I said, "Oh my God, there's Colin Pollock."
Okay, well that's a good point of reference. I didn't think of it like that.
Yeah, that's how I managed to go back to that. Colin Pollock, Tim Roth, in his first film, I believe it was first or second movie.
Yeah, he was in one called Made in Britain. I've only seen snippets of that, and it doesn't look as. Interesting as Meantime, but I'll have to give it a watch.
Like to watch it,
yeah,
for sure.
Maybe one day we'll have to sit and watch it together.
Yeah, Gary Oldman as Coxie.
Yeah, well, I knew him from JFK, obviously.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That's where I'd seen him from.
Yep, and also I also seen him in State of Grace from 1990. And also Sid and Nancy.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't aware he was in that, but I'd heard of the film, yeah.
But I saw Sid and Nancy in 86 when it came out. I played at... I won some tickets off. Where did Alan Thomas used to play? Triple R?
Three Triple R.
Yeah, Triple R, yeah. I won some tickets off there and went and saw Sid and Nancy at age 14 or 15, well, underage. But what was that cinema where we went and saw After Hours? Do you remember what it was called? Was it the Como?
Jeez, South Yarra?
South Yarra.
South Yarra, God.
I think it was the Como.
Yeah, that sounds. Yeah.
And I won tickets to see Sid and Nancy and watched it at the Como. And that was the first time I ever saw Gary Oldman.
Okay.
I'd not seen Meantime by this time. Also stars Jeff Robert as Frank Pollock.
Yeah, I looked it up recently, and there's no other reference of him in any other movie or TV show. Just he's not even listed on Wikipedia.
No.
He's just got that sort of...
He's got the red name.
That's it?
Yeah,
that's
it's just his name in red there. It's also got Phil Daniels...
Yeah,
as Mark Pollock,
who I think I've seen him in a few other things. He was in that film that you watched around the same time, Quadrophenia.
Quadrophenia, yeah, based on the Who album, yeah. And he was also in Time Gentlemen,
yeah,
Please.
That was a bit later on, but he was equally as funny in that as he is in this film.
Fucking farting everywhere all the time. and was it another thing? I think I saw him in. No, I think I have. Scum. I saw him in that film, Scum, based in the British Borstal.
That was that film in the late 70s?
79.
Ray Winston,
yeah. Yeah, from 79. That was a fucking brutal-ass movie, that one. Also stars Pam Ferris. For those of you who do watch British television would know her from The Darling Buds of May, show I never really got into, with David Jason as well.
Yeah, I know the show, but I don't really... I don't watch it.
No, it wasn't my sort of thing that I wanted to watch. Alfred Molina in there, and he's one of your first movies?
Alfred Molina, I first saw him in Raiders of the Lost Ark, covered in tarantulas.
Oh, shit, was that him?
That's him, yeah.
I had no idea. I've seen Raiders, obviously, but I didn't even know.
I thought you pointed that out to me. He was the guy who was covered in the tarantulas at the start of...
Oh, there you go.
You know the one that said, "Throw me the idol"?
Yeah.
That's Alfred Molina.
My goodness.
Pretty sure it's him, but I'm almost certain that's him.
Oh, yeah. What? Raiders was 81. This is what, 80, made in 83. Yeah. Okay.
He's been in a lot of films, Alfred Molina.
Oh, bloody oath. Heaps. And also stars Marion Bailey.
She plays Babs or Barbara.
Yeah, Barbara.
Auntie Barbara.
Yeah. Also known as Mrs. Mike Lee.
Oh, is she married to Mike Lee?
She's married to Mike Lee, yeah.
That's something I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the main principal cast there.
Is that Tilly Vosburg?
Oh, Tilly Vosburg, yeah. Is Hayley. Hayley!
Quasimodo's daughter.
Quasimodo's daughter.
And can you remember the name of the West Indian guy?
Hepburn Graham. Only because we just saw the credits about 15 minutes ago. Yeah.
I said to Stu, I said he's got the name of a West Indian fast bowler. Yes. For those of you who know cricket.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I can't remember the name of his girlfriend, but her name gets mentioned at the end as well.
Oh, a new pram. Oh, a new one. A present from uncle's a ticket.
A present from uncle's a ticket.
Alan Bushaw.
Oh God. Yeah. Anyway, we're just self indulging here, people.
Yeah, you're gonna hear lines from us. You're gonna think these guys are just off their face. Well, they're not. We just, like I said, we've seen this film that many times. It's just ridiculous.
If we do get into a bit of a self indulgent tangent for a bit, just
bear with us.
Yeah,
you'll be right. Hopefully, make you want to go out and watch the movie, which you should do anyway. I would say I'd probably seen this film, for those of you who listen to the show, as many times as I've seen Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. And that, listen to the show, know that's a fucking lot.
It's a real guilty pleasure. And
I wouldn't say you feel guilty watching this, actually. Because it's really well made.
Yeah, it is. It's a very well made film, very well made sort of independent film. And but again, it's not going to be for everybody. Like I know some people who've seen it and said they were bored to tears watching it.
Oh yeah.
So it's either one of those films. I reckon if you watch it, you'll either like it or you won't. There won't be anything in between.
No. Yeah. You're either going to love it or you're going to really not like it. You know. I wouldn't say hate it. I think I'd be hard pressed to find people who really hate it unless they're one of those, you know, younger crowds go, oh, I don't like this movie, man. I don't get it.
There wasn't
not enough explosions.
Not enough Lezos in it.
No. The Rock wasn't in there as well. Fucking, you know.
So, yeah, but I mean, you got to sort of go into this movie not taking it too dark and getting too damn depressed about the whole thing.
No.
The English are good at sort of taking the piss out of themselves as well. So
yeah.
I think there's a bit of that in the film as well.
Oh, a lot. Yeah, a lot of self-effacing humor.
You know,
yeah.
Some of the lines from Mark Pollock, you know, when Frank Pollock says, you know, really got your goat, him getting that job, and he said, I ain't got a goat, you know. I mean, how can you not find that stuff funny?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's just,
Again, it's British humor, and if that's not your thing, then I don't know, go and watch The Big Bang Theory or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I've said forever that the Brits are the funniest. You know, don't know about now, but they were back then.
Yeah, it's changed a lot now. Even they've lost it a bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the cast that we just covered.
Yeah.
That's about it, really, I think, with the cast.
Yeah,
the
main car.
Oh, is that guy?
Rusty.
Rusty. Oh, yeah.
The glue head. Yeah, glue.
Rusty. He's a cameo.
Paul Daly, his name
and
is.
And that social worker, or the guy that works in the council estate.
Oh, I don't know.
He gets mentioned in the credits. But
oh, he does. Peter something, his name was.
Looks like a bloody Bob Geldof type, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, espousing about, you know, ants, anthills and shit. It's like, did you work out what he was saying when he was talking about the grain to let us know about the grain before telling us about the anthill?
I think he was kind of sort of encouraging them to sort of be more self-help, help themselves, will be more self-help. Is that?
I saw it as him. I took it away as him saying, let us know about the problem before, not towards when everything's building up.
Because
they have windows breaking, you know, staffed and all that.
Don't let the sort of problem, you know,
escalate.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. But he was saying it in his own weird way. And then poor old Colin goes, we got ants.
Got ants.
We got ants.
What?
Anyway, yeah, so.
Well, let's give a quick rundown of the premise. It's just basically the Pollock family. Frank and Mavis are the mother and father, husband, wife, and Colin and Mark are the two sons, Mark being the oldest, Colin the younger by what, maybe two, three years, you reckon?
Yeah, about that.
And they go and visit their auntie Barbara and Uncle John at the start of the film, who are a well-to-do couple, who Barbara is the sister of Mavis, and has sort of gotten herself out of East London, and
yeah, she's made something for herself.
Made something for herself, and you know, married into some sort of you know, richer lifestyle that she's got. And then you go from the sort of vision of them being in that house and that nice area to them being dumped back at the
coming back to their council
to their
state.
Council estate flat, and basically living in squalor and just, you know, no sense of sort of real life in the place, and everybody's just on the dole in there. And
don't forget that film was set in that sort of time when the whole Thatcher era,
Britain, they certainly call
when there was, like, you know, millions unemployed, so it was a pretty bad place to be. Spoken to a few people who lived through that, and they said, yeah, it wasn't fun. A lot of coal miners got laid off and all that, so unemployment was very high, and you know, the enthusiasm around the place was pretty low.
There's also that period as well where the best comedy shows came out of Britain.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
The Young Ones was one.
Yeah, well, Young Ones is a classic example of that era. So.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, we get the Pollock family just basically living in their East London council estate flat, and they've been there for 19 years.
Yeah, according to Auntie Barbara, 19 years.
You know, yeah. since 63 or something, 64, whatever it was. And you can tell they're ashamed that they've been living there nearly two decades. But, yeah, and it's just about the day-to-day going on. There's no real three-act structure this film, is there?
It just sort of rolls along. And
It just rolls yeah. along. It doesn't. There's no real set time frame of, okay, you know, it's set in 7 days or it just...
Kind of reflects the sort of lifestyle, you know, just sort of drags on and you don't know...
Just, yeah, time, that's right, time just drags on. And one day becomes another and you don't really... You know, there's no real event of one day for you to say, okay, so that's what was one day, then this and that. It's just you don't know. Like, there was a part you brought up where you were saying, which you thought might have been an edit fault or an edit...
Yeah, I was just... I found it a bit strange how that part got into that sort of...
Yeah, where Mark Pollock is just walking through...
I think it's Trafalgar Square.
Piccadilly Circus, Trafalgar Square.
Yeah, around there somewhere.
Around there, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'd never even thought about it until you pointed out tonight.
I was under the impression that was... him heading off to Auntie Barbara's.
No.
But I worked out, it was just, remember they said he's sodded off somewhere and so he might just...
I think, you know what I think it was? I think it was, and we're going to give probably spoilers away, but I mean, there's nothing really, you know, there's no big Sixth Sense ending in this film where, you know what that film ending is, where he says towards the end, I'm going away, I want to get out of here.
Yeah.
I think it was just him wanting to get away from East London, into London, just to get away and just experience life elsewhere out of the doldrums of the council estate.
For all the sort of funny lines he pulls out and that, there are moments where, you know, any time, you know, his unemployed status gets pulled up into the mix, you can see it strikes a raw nerve with him.
Yeah, it does.
So, you know, there are those parts of the film where you can see, you know, where the funny side of him takes a back seat.
Yeah. And it's also when Colin gets offered a job by... their Aunt Barbara to go and do some painting and decorating in her place. She's going to pay him £1.20 an hour. I don't know what the going rate for pay was back in 83, 84, but Christ, like today, it sounds like beyond slave wages.
That's an hour, though. So
it's an hour, yeah. Plus £4 train fare.
That's it.
Yeah.
Plus his fish finger or beef burger at lunch.
Oh, yeah, fish fingers or beef burgers. So, yeah, once that happened and Colin accepts the employment or the job, Mark gets really...
Bent out of shape,
yeah, really pissed off about it and happens to go to Barbara's house that day before Colin gets there and basically ruins it and says, you know, don't become a slave, just come home. And
yeah, but that's towards the end of the film, so we sort of...
We're going to be jumping about non-linear with this one for sure. But there's also, you know, many, many funny parts in there. And I'll let you get your notes in a sec. Yeah, where you've got them just in the pub playing pool.
Yeah, I mean, the film's sort of set around their actual flat where they live, like a two-bedroom flat.
Yeah.
At the sort of pub, which I take it is sort of somewhere in that...
Probably that district there, probably not far away,
probably
5-minute walk or something, I'd imagine.
Yeah, a couple of scenes at Auntie Barbara's place, which is up in Chigwell.
Yeah.
The doll office scene, that's a quick scene. So... For me, the first funny line of the movie is when they arrive at Auntie Barbara's place and they've been Colin and Mark have been told to take their shoes off because their house is all neat, prim and proper and everything. And Colin takes his shoes off and then Mark says, "We're good boys, aren't we?
Good boys, aren't we?"
Pinches his cheek.
Good boys, aren't we?
Well, that's where the comedy hits off for me. I mean,
yeah, that's probably about right. Yeah.
And then they head off into, you know, they're getting, you know, cups of tea ready for everyone because I think it's a Sunday afternoon type thing. And,
probably.
And Mark hops onto the TV cabinet and his father, Frank, says to him,
Get down.
No.
No.
You'll break it.
Good.
Then you can pay for it.
You'll break it.
Yeah.
What do you care? Just the exchange between...
And you can pay for it.
Just the exchange between Mark and Frank for the whole movie is absolute comedy for me.
Did you notice? I mean, I know you've noticed as well. They never call Mavis Mum.
No, there's
they always call. They call Frank sometimes. They also call him Dad as well.
Yeah,
but never Mavis's Mum.
Yeah, you get the impression that there's not much respect given back and forth between the parents and the kids.
No,
So,
no, there's a lot of shut ups, and I don't know what's more. I think the most common phrase in this film is "all right."
Yeah,
all right,
yeah. Very, very London dialect, as we talked about before. And then, you know, Mark, he's being points out later. He says, "being a yob." You know, he's not very respectful to anyone, and he's a bit of a cheeky sod, in a disrespectful sort of way. And he's talking about, the house at Marty Barber's house ain't worth robbing.
Yeah.
And then Frank's just said, listen to him, the master criminal.
Listen to the master criminal.
It's a doddle, this house.
Have you been casing the joint, Mark?
It ain't worth it.
Listen to him, the master criminal.
So, anyway, that scene wraps up. And then as they're leaving, Auntie Barbara gives Colin a going away treat.
Yeah. Marshmallows.
Yeah, it gives him a little packet of marshmallows.
Yeah.
Marshmallows.
And he's...
Looks like a bag's already been half opened as well.
I think it has, yeah.
It's like he just palm off the marshmallows to Colin.
Yeah, before we throw these out, we'll give him away.
Probably out of date as well. He wouldn't give a shit.
What are you giving him now? Marshmallows.
Marshmallows.
Yeah. So that's a line we always laugh at.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then Uncle John drives him back to the council estate.
Just fucking dumps him straight out there. Just dumps him off and floors it out of there.
Gets in the car, just walks off, doesn't say thank you, nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, then we take it back to the flat, and lots of funny exchanges happen there.
Yeah, just basically the three guys sitting on the couch watching TV. And
then that's when we first see Mark and Colin's bedroom.
Oh, my God, mate. Fucking disgusting.
Puts on that punk album.
And he throws darts at Kim Wilde.
One, two, three, four. Yeah, then he gets the darts and says, I can make a monkey out of Kim Wilde.
I can make a monkey out of Kim Wilde.
He throws a dart at Kim Wilde.
One, two, three, four. Make a monkey out of Kim Wilde.
That's where you see their bedroom, which is completely disheveled.
Disgusting.
Yeah. And then we get down to the doll office scene.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
That's one of the scenes we always found funny because, you know, having been on the doll in the past.
Yep.
You know, you go down to the doll office and it is a...
It's not exactly pleasant.
Yeah. I don't know, do they...
I just remember when I went there one time when I was, before I was working, like, I don't know, I was like 17 or something. I was reading Stephen King's It, the book. Right? Some guy walked in with a T-shirt and a doll office and said, the Hitler World Tour. And all these fucking places Hitler invaded on the back of the shirt, 1939 to 1945. It's like, what the fuck's this guy wearing his shirt for in the bloody doll office, the Hitler World Tour?
They don't, people don't exactly get dressed up for the doll office, do they? Certain people don't, anyway.
Bond's got T-shirts, mate. They're rampant doll office.
And in this film, it's much the same. You see Colin, they all turn up to the Dolphus roughly at the same time. And Colin's being served. Actually, before we get onto that, is that a term used in other parts outside of England and Australia?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
I don't even know what the Dole stands for. Is it Department of Labour Exchange? Or
could be, yeah.
Something. Anyway, when the term on the Dole means you're unemployed.
Well, it's like the band UB40. You know, that band, that's what UB40 stands for. On the bottom of the Dole form, it's unemployment benefits 4-0.
Oh, okay. I didn't know
that's what UB40 is, yeah.
Learn something new every day.
Yeah.
And you'll often hear terms like someone's on the sausage roll or on the Chico roll.
Chico roll, yeah. That's
roll. That means you're on the Dole. So
yeah.
It's just rhyming slang.
All of us were on the Dole about, what was it, like 1998? When was Paul Keating in power? 1988.
Something like
1988, that. 1988, yeah. So it was about 1988. And we just get our doll money and go to Hungry Jack's or Burger King, same shit thing. Go for a fucking all-you-can-eat Chinese.
Or you'd go straight down to Metal from Melbourne and buy the latest metal album.
Oh, yeah, you'd do that for sure. Yeah.
Stuart, I'm heading off down to Metal from Melbourne to get the latest Overkill album or something.
Yeah, bloody oath, mate. That was always something that would happen once a year.
We used to, what was that term? Brother Paul's shout, wasn't it? Brother Paul's shout.
Yeah, Brother Paul. Brother Paul Keating, yeah.
Yeah, shout. His shout.
Yeah.
Yeah, his
brother. Drunk. Brother Paul paid for this.
So, yeah, the good old doll. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, not so good, mate.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, back then it was all right. You know, you get your 300 and something bucks a fortnight. You think it was like Christmas.
Have a bit of a comment on the doll office scene, which is always pretty funny.
It's pretty grimy.
It's just
bodies in there everywhere, people lining up. stink to high buggery.
Well, the film gives you that very uncomfortable feel of everybody's unwashed.
Yeah.
You know, you can almost smell.
Well, that's a term that they say about the Brits in the 60s was the great unwashed.
Yeah.
So I don't know if Mike Lee was playing on that or something like that. Or
they do have that look about them, a very disheveled look about them, and it comes across in the film.
Yeah, well, the disheveled look will come from the fact that they don't care about their appearance.
Oh, yeah.
They got nothing to... You know, the only time you ever see Colin really get sort of dressed up is to go, you know, work on the paint and decorating.
Yeah.
Apart from that, every other time he's just got that same jacket on.
His glasses have got that bit of sticky tape.
Sticky tape on the end, yeah, on the end of the frame.
So, the doll office scene, you see Colin, he's handing in his form and he's getting a telling down to from the doll office worker and asking for his details because he's lost his card, didn't he?
Yeah, he lost his card.
Lost his card or his form. And she's asking, what's your name? And and his father, Frank's right behind him in the queue. And you can take it from here.
He goes, Colin. She goes, what's your surname? And he just sees silence here. Pollock!
We left it at home. Where do you normally keep it?
Pocket.
Which pocket?
Trousers.
What's your name?
Colin.
Surname?
Pollock. Pollock.
Frank at the back. And she asks, what's his address? Can you remember his address off the top of your head?
111 Bryant Court, Western Road, London, E2, wasn't
that's
it?
Yeah. And then she starts having, the doll office worker starts having a go at Colin for being, forgetful and lazy and that. And then Frank at the back says, you're all right, we don't want a lecture. And then as he's filling out his form, or his new form, whatever, Frank tries to push. tries to push it. Oh, fuck it up. What did she say to him?
Yeah, you can do mine while you're waiting.
No, you wait your turn.
Wasn't jumping a queue, was I?
I didn't say you were.
Just thought I'd save you a bit of time, that's all.
I'm not in a hurry. Are you?
Yes, I am.
Oh, shit.
This is what we're getting at. None of this shit's funny. Like, people will watch it and go, what's so funny about this? To us, it's fucking hysterical. We're just like...
What does she say to him?
Wait your turn.
Because it wasn't jump the queue, was I? He goes, what does she say? I'm not in a hurry.
He goes, yes, I am. Seriously, we're in a hurry to go to Frank. Back to the council estate. To the pub. Didn't he go to the pub just after that?
Yeah, he went for a pint.
For a beer.
But did you see when, that's happening... Colin's filling out the form. He's got the bloody
got the fucking pen lid. Top of the pen lid.
He's got the pen lid in his mouth.
And he gives the pen back to her. And he puts the pen lid back on. She chucks it straight in the bin. What a grub! Just chewing on a pen lid.
Yeah, and in that part, you see Mark in the background. He's about three people back in the queue.
Yeah,
and eventually his turn comes, and in his typical sort of wit humor, she asks him, "Have you done any work in the last 2 weeks?"
Yeah.
And what does he say?
This week I'm spying on doll office workers, determining the movements between 12 and 2.
Done any work in the past 2 weeks?
Yeah. Been working for the police, giving them information about various robberies and murders. Now, that was week before last. This week I'm spying on doll office workers, determining their movements between 12 and 2 in the afternoon.
You don't make our job any easier, you know.
We're not talking about your job. We're talking about our jobs.
My pen, please.
Our pen.
Yeah, it's all right. And then, and she starts lecturing him about, you know, all sorts of things. And And he has a go back of it. And she said, you don't make our jobs any easier. And he said,
I'm not talking about your jobs. I'm talking about our jobs.
Can I have my pen back, please?
Our pen.
He slams on the table and rolls it over to her. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this isn't everyone's idea of comedy, but for us, I mean, it just sends us into fits of laughter every time.
We'll piss ourselves off watching again tonight.
Every time I watch it, I end up having a
fit
of laughter.
See, the thing is, well, we know this bloody movie line for line, like literally line for line.
Yeah, there are times where I'll watch it and I just know what's coming up.
Yeah, you know what's coming up, but you just brace yourself and you just laugh anyway.
And then, after Colin finishes up, he's waiting out the front of the doll office.
Yeah, Coxie.
And Coxie, we see Coxie.
We better paint the picture. Coxie's played by Gary Oldman, is actually a skinhead.
Yeah.
You know, with Doc Martin boots and, braces and...
The whole bang, yeah.
Yeah, the whole 9 yards sort of thing with him. And he is literally a Nazi, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, what people would class as a neo-Nazi. That's what you see.
Because you see later on when he deals with that, when that black guy, I guess the Pakistani Indian guy was in the pub, and he goes, go on, get him lemonade.
Yeah, he's very what people would call racist.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah.
But there's like four skinheads at the front of the doll office, and one of them's Coxie, who we see throughout the movie, and Colin's waiting at the front, and Frank walks out. Can you remember what he says to Colin?
What are you trying to do, eh?
What are you trying to do, eh?
It just walks off.
It just walks off.
And there's Colin out the front. I think Colin, you get to see in this movie, Colin sort of feels a bit alienated, and he's trying to
break out of his shell.
Yeah, and he's trying to sort of find a sort of a
group, an identity.
Yeah. And he sort of gravitates towards Coxie, who's a...
He's probably the worst one.
Yeah, a very bad influence. But,
yeah.
I mean, living where he lives, there's not much of anywhere to turn to. And he looks up to his... In a weird way, he looks up to his brother.
Yeah, he does look up to his brother. Yeah, for sure.
You know, he obviously looks up to him as, you know... But Coxie's the one who sort of is the sort of bad influence on him. And as you see later on the film...
Yeah.
He tries to emulate Coxie in
Well, because he's trying to get with Hayley as well, Colin is.
Yeah.
And because Coxie just managed to walk in the door to her place and get in there, and he goes with him, and when he tries later on, she just says, no.
Yeah, he gets rebuffed.
Totally
rebuffed.
So that's when he does what he does at the end, which we won't give away.
Yeah. We won't give that part away. But where were we? We were at the doll. Yeah. So then, they've done their 2 week reporting, and now they've sort of got a bit of free time. And we see obviously Mark and Coxie. I get the impression they must have grown up on the council estate together.
Probably, yeah. They've been there so long.
Mark doesn't seem to have any fear of Coxie.
Nah.
Just sees him as a bit of a prat.
Yeah.
And then they go off. And they're that big wrecking ball demolishing that building.
Oh, my God, yeah. This fucking wrecking ball just smashing, demolishing this building. They just, as the ball's swinging towards them, they're just going, running towards them, running away. And, yeah, probably not the smartest thing to do. But
And don't forget Colin standing at the front of the Dolphins with his big stick.
With his stick, holding the bloody stick cocks he was whacking about, yeah.
Yeah, so I think by this stage we start to get a feel for the characters when they go to the pub and you see Hayley there and...
Yeah, she's just sort of this despondent woman who just, just has nothing else to look forward to.
Yeah, she comes across as a bit retarded in the film at times.
Yeah, a little bit. I think she's just not really, doesn't really see much future at all.
Yeah, I can't...
She's not going to find the right guy in East London, in that area. And the other thing we seem to just have the money to move up and move away, pack up and move away. So there's a sense of urgency that they're not going to really, things are not going to get any better for them.
Yeah, and you get that sense with all the characters in the film.
For sure.
You know, every character that's in the film, you just see, I mean, apart from, Barbara and Uncle John.
Yeah, but then again, you see towards later on when she's drunk, it's the only time that she sort of reverts back to her East London roots and drops a sort of charade of being someone who's more upper class than she really is.
Yeah, you get the impression as the film develops, as the film goes on, that hers and John's marriage isn't as
rosy as it's
as, yeah, made as they paint out. Yeah. Yeah. No,
so
far from
there
it.
Is that. So after the doll scene, we end up in one of the pub scenes, don't we? Where what happens there? That's right. They're just at the pub and
yeah,
you get to see you meet Coxie and Rusty, and you know it just sort of
yeah, just usual you know dumb sort of shenanigans that someone would get up to when they you know, got really nothing to do, just you know playing about and sort of disrupting the people in the pub, which is not many of them. There's only you know a few old boys in there. Having a beer and stuff.
On the other side of the bar, yeah.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, it goes back and forth from the pub and then to the flat. You know, there's that scene with the washing machine where the washing machine goes on the blink. And
it's funny how when that was filmed, it was all just filmed directly on the washing machine.
Yeah.
There's just people's legs walking in and out of the frame. It was just there was just a static shot on the washing machine door.
Yeah, it was quite interesting.
Yeah, it was well
yeah.
done, that was.
Yeah, it sort of takes your away from what's happening, just listening.
Yeah, you don't need to close up of this person and that person, this person. You know who's who because, you know, you hear their names and you hear their voices. And by this time, they're all got unique voices that you can differentiate who is who.
Yeah, yeah. And by that stage, you know who's who. And
yeah.
And obviously, you know, Mark's sort of sense of humor, you know, during that scene, you know, when... You know, they're trying to open the door to the washing machine and he says, dynamite it.
Dynamite it. Yeah.
Dynamite it.
There's some classic lines in that part as well. Like, you know, when Mavis doesn't know if she owns the washing machine outright and Frank says, that's handy, you don't know.
Hey, you own the door and that part don't work.
Yeah, I mean, all that sort of stuff, you know. And then Colin gets called up to try and fix it and Mark says, boot it.
Yeah, and he literally kicks it and she kicks him out of there, yeah.
Slap across the head and throws him out.
What am I supposed to tell him?
Take it back.
Well, we've had it 3 years. Oh, my Mark.
You pay for it.
What do you mean paid for it?
I mean, can we call it our own? That's what I mean.
Paid enough.
And you pay for it, haven't you?
Well, I don't know.
That's Andy, you don't know.
Dynamite it.
Shut up.
You haven't finished paying for it, have you?
I haven't paid for all of it.
Yeah, you pay for the door, and that bit don't work.
Get a new one.
Who pulled your chain, Colin Pollock?
Tell you what.
What?
Why don't you get a goldfish and stick it in where you put the powder?
I wonder how much new ones are.
Goldfish?
Nah, piranhas, you mug.
Don't call me that.
Colin, stop talking. Come in here. You try.
What?
Opening the door!
Boot it.
Get out. Come on, get out.
But that leads us to the laundromat scene.
Colin's got the old style laundry basket with the actual lid that comes off from it covering his face.
He gets sent along with Mavis takes him along to wait for the laundry to finish and he's got that lid. Covering his face with a lid during the part where she's explaining what he needs to do. And then as she's taking off, he asks her...
Hey, Jules, got some fag money?
What do you want fag money for?
Cigarettes.
Get your own. Ain't got no money.
Ain't got no money. You hear that term a lot in this film. Ain't got no money.
Yeah.
You got the money? Ain't got no money.
And then he gets stuck in the laundromat with Haley and the West Indian lady.
Yeah.
And... I mean, like I said, there's no real sort of sequence.
I was going to show you something tonight. I don't know if you ever noticed it. You know, in the council estate, the lift area has got a lot of graffiti in there.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking at some of that.
Did you see someone written Iron Maiden?
I thought I saw that. Yeah, I thought I saw Iron Maiden. I saw something Maiden, and I thought, is that Iron Maiden?
Yeah, it was Iron Maiden.
All right, and I saw another one said MUFC Red Devils, so Man United.
Manchester United. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that as well. But I thought I saw something about Iron Maiden, but I wasn't 100% sure. Okay.
What about the scene they have in the lift with the West Indian guy?
Yeah, well, that's a bit later on, but
yeah,
I mean, that's an interesting part of the film. I mean, because you know you. Sort of
that brings out the side of Coxie where you think, does he look like a skinhead or is he actually, you know, a racist skinhead? And you see that part, yeah. He's
pretty much it, you know, he plays the part of the you know, racist.
I mean, there was no need to go off of the West Indian guy. He was doing nothing, he was just taking a pram up through the lift, you know. especially calls him, you know, BC, you know, that stands for.
What's BC?
Black c***.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I thought he was saying A and then he thought he was saying B and C.
No.
A, B, C. All right, see, I didn't pick up on that part.
Yeah.
That's the part when they go over to Haley's place and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see a darker side of Coxie, you know,
You see this guy, he's always laughing and playing around. You sort of see, you do see the dark side of him when he's being an arsehole to Kaylee in the house.
That nasty streak in him.
Yeah.
The typical sort of bully.
Yeah, for sure. Probably full of shit bully as well. Because when you see the West Indian guy whacks him in the head, he does nothing about it.
Yeah. He kicks Colin up the arse later on.
Kick Colin up the arse.
He takes his aggression out on Colin.
On Colin, because Colin's going to do nothing about it.
Yeah.
Whereas, the West Indian guy was the only one who really challenged Coxie. And he just cowered off and did nothing about it. So, and takes his aggression out on Colin, and then takes it out on Haley later.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
Because he's too gutless to have stood up to a guy who he's supposed to be so hateful of. And was basically, beaten down, but not physically beaten down, but sort of ridiculed.
Yeah, but that exchange in the lift is quite quite challenging if you're not used to the London dialect as it's.
That's probably the one scene that has the most of the heavy dialect,
And also, the West Indian guy's got a very thick West Indian accent.
Oh, very much, yeah.
And you have to really listen carefully to what
he says. Well, we turned on the subtitles for him because we've argued for bloody... Not argued, but we've debated for years. What does he call it? What does he say there?
I thought he said, you dirty pillhead Razio.
Razio. I said the other day, what's a Razio?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. That's what it sounds like coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But then on the subtitle, it said, you dirty pill...
Head of Ross.
Ross, you. Ross, you. Why?
Dirty pillhead Razio.
But anyway, let's get back to the film. I mean, I guess one of the things... You can't really do with this film is try and pick it apart and try and overanalyze it.
No, you can't.
It just basically depicts life on the dole, life in those council estates, the drudgery, the dreariness of...
Kitchen sink drama, they call it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
It does, but it does it very well in depicting that sort of lifestyle, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's about as realistic film as I've ever seen.
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah. It's, it's certainly not one of those... films where you look at it and you go, no way. It's never going to happen in real life.
I'll tell you one of the other things I find really good about that is if you look at, Frank, Mark, Colin and Mavis, they really do look like an actual family.
They look like a real family. The two sons look like real brothers and they really look like their father.
It's very, very convincing. Like you watch movies and you see families, you think, contrived and they don't look like a family, but this looks like a real family.
It does. It looks like you can buy it as the family.
Oh, definitely. Even the dynamics between them. I mean, it's so real. It's
brilliantly acted. I mean, this is about as good as a film I've ever seen of anything, I think.
But again, like I said, a lot of people find it boring because
nothing happens.
Yeah.
Because really nothing happens.
Yeah.
Everyone's like a lot of younger people. Their minds have been now sort of programmed to think, okay, something's going to happen. Within the first 15 minutes, and then it's going to be another 10 minutes, and it's going to follow beats where it's going to have something happen, and then, but this film nothing happens, and you'll sit there and you'll wait and you'll wait and you'll wait, and I fell victim to that with Rio Bravo, which is the episode we did just recently, where I sat there and I thought, oh, it's going to be like Assault on Precinct 13, the John Carpenter film, because it was based off of that, and nothing happened and nothing happened and nothing happened, and I didn't like it. So I've said to myself, I need to sit and watch it again, which is something I said I wouldn't do, but I will. And I did say in the episode, it was me. It's my fault. And which is what a lot of people will do with this. A lot of people, I would say, unless you grew up in that time, I'd say even in London, and you could identify with it, you would get it.
I've got it.
You get what Mike Lee was aiming for with the film. But... And this is no disrespect to anybody, say in America or something. I'm just using it simply as an example. If you live down south in there, say out in Mississippi, let's say, right, you're going to have no connection to this film. It's going to be so far removed from you. You're going to think, I don't get it.
Well, here's the funny thing. I mean, I met a lot of English people, British people, and American people over the years, and they just don't seem to be able to. Get each other, do they?
No.
Whether it be TV shows or sport, they seem to be worlds apart. And, in Australia, we were fortunate enough growing up where we got all the best a lot of great English shows on TV and a lot of great American shows on TV, plus our own sort of our own stuff. So,
like Bobby Dazzler.
What's Bobby Dazzler?
Remember John Farnham?
Oh, fuck Johnny Farnham. I'm talking about stuff like, going back, in that regard, we were kind of spoilt.
Yeah, for sure.
Best of both worlds, you know.
Yeah.
Plus, our father's from London. I don't know if many people know our father's from London. So when we were getting a telling off from our dad, you know, a lot of the...
His English accent would really come out.
His English accent would come out. His London accent would come out. The terms, some of the words.
You know what I thought, though? It's lucky that we hadn't seen this film while we were still a young kid, because when Dad would tell us off, we'd probably just start pissing ourselves off.
Well, we used to start pissing ourselves sometimes when he's holding a cigarette and the ash was getting really long. And I'd just pray the ash wouldn't fall on the ground, because I'd start pissing
myself
laughing.
Fucking piss yourself laughing,
get a clip around the ear.
Yeah.
But there's one part in the film where Frank at the end, when there's that sort of big argument at the end of the film, where he says to Mark, "All right, smart ass, you tell me why he jacked that job in."
Yeah.
You know, that term, smart ass, we used to hear that all the time.
Oh, yeah, Dad was like, you're a smart ass.
Yeah, just
a bit smart ass.
Yeah. So, you know, we could really associate with a lot of the language in this film.
Did you ever call Dad a rollick?
No. I mean, that went like bloody lightning. Oh, God.
All right, then, smart ass. You tell me how come he jacked that job in. Don't matter what I just did, all right? What's that supposed to mean? Don't ask me. Ask him, you rollick. If I'd have talked to my old man like that, I would have been out that window like bloody lightning. Shut up! You're talking to me? Yeah!
I'm going to go... Before we finish, I'm going to go through some of the classic lines in this film, because you can't mention.
So we'll be here another 2 hours. I'm just saying, is that many of them?
We could do, but we'll just go brush through some of the ones I've written down.
Yeah.
But, one of the things I picked up on when I was watching on YouTube, a lot of people on there were either, again, like I said, they were either for it or against it. They either liked it or hated it.
Mm.
And a lot of people were sort of, you know, being very negative about the actual score.
Yeah,
and I thought the score worked quite well with the film. It sort of
The score was fantastic. Yeah. It's minimal, and it's not the latest sort of punk rock songs from the UK at the time, which would have ruined the movie.
Yeah, well, it's just
didn't need it.
It's just a piano and a
It was like a trumpet or a bugle or something.
Some sort of horn,
something in the horn section.
But it's just two instruments. And at the end of the film, you see the music credits. There's two names on there.
Mm.
So it must have been just two blokes who...
Yeah, it would have been a small budget film. They couldn't afford to get, music licensing for The Clash or bands like that. They just wouldn't have...
Yeah, personally, I thought the actual score just helped the movie along. And, it was there. It wasn't too overbearing. And
it's not like you get films, these days, or especially back in the 2000s, where they have to jam six songs in on the end credit, for 30, 40 seconds a year. Another 40 seconds. Why? Just to sell the damn soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't need it. It's a TV movie, small budget, unknown cast.
Yeah, it was very minimalist, but it was it worked,
No, it does, because, 30-something years later, two guys in another country are talking about it.
Yeah.
And I've seen it that many times.
And like I said, the main selling point for us is just the dialogue exchanges between the brothers, the father, and...
Oh, here's a question I got for you. Who's the funniest in the film?
Oh, without a doubt, for me, it's Mark.
Mark Pollock,
Without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about this before. I said, who are your three favourite characters in the film? But funniest is Mark.
Pollock, yeah.
He kills it.
Phil Daniels, yeah.
Yeah, he absolutely kills it.
I don't know how much of this was actually improvised. I don't know.
I'd say some of it must have been, because it's...
I reckon it would have been.
Sounds very off the cuff, some of it, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, I think... I like Mark Pollock, but I like it even more when it's Mark and Frank.
Yeah, the Mark.
When it's those two going at each other, that's the funniest part of the movie for sure.
The Mark and Frank exchanges are some of the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life.
Oh my God, mate!
I mean, okay, one of the scenes when they're sitting on the sofa there on the couch, and Mark's got the ashtray on his chest, he's smoking away with his feet up, and Frank's sitting next to him in his dressing gown reading the paper. And there's some, it must have been on the front page or the third, page three, whatever.
Yeah.
Some young...
page three girl, they call me, the sun, yeah.
Page three, that's it. And there's some young girl bearing it all
yeah.
on the
in the photo. And what does he say? What does Frank say? He says,
"Well, he got a number."
No, Frank says, "Look at that."
Typical your generation, isn't it?
Yeah, and then was Mark says, "Oh, how come there's steam coming out your ear holes?"
You know? How come there's steam coming out your ear holes?
And then my favourite line is when Frank says to him, he goes, "Listen, you get some little slight into trouble, don't come to me for help."
What, like you? Born in wedlock, mate, you were right and proper.
Yeah, he said, typical generation, that is. You ever been around trying to make a phone call around here?
Well, you got a number.
Yeah, you got a number, Frank.
Who are there? 16 years old. Schoolgirl showing her all in a paper.
Kiss her, look.
It's yesterday's.
Don't read that.
She ain't got nothing to show anyway.
Well, how comes there's steam coming out of your ear holes?
Typically your generation, that is. You ever try to make a phone call round here? Got to walk miles before you can find a box that ain't been ripped out, vandalised.
Why, you got a number then, Frank?
Eh?
Guess it.
You think I'd go for a little scrubber like that?
No, you only go for decent women, didn't you?
Married man I am. I know my place. Stick to the straight and narrow. Of course, that's something you wouldn't understand.
Wouldn't I?
I'll tell you something. You get some little slut into trouble, don't you come running to me for help.
Oh, you can talk, can't you, Frank?
You what?
Look at me.
Born in wedlock, you was, right and proper.
Only just. See you later, Dad.
I mean, you know, you couldn't write that shit.
No, you couldn't.
So if some of that stuff's improvised, then hats off to those two, because that's some funny shit, mate.
Oh, for sure. It's also Colin as well. Colin, probably played by Tim Roth, he doesn't really have a great... He has a lot of lines, but they're one-worded.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
You know, I ain't got no money or something. Just, yeah, you know, there's no monologue lines like Mark Pollock has.
In the movie, he comes across as very articulate and witty.
Yeah.
Although he's a smart aleck.
He's a smart ass for sure.
And there's a degree of bitterness in his...
But you said to me as we were watching this tonight, just now, the one who has the most facial expressions in the film is Colin.
Yeah.
You say, look here, just a sec, look at his face here. And he's got a lot of facial expressions, whereas the others really don't, because his is dialogue driven.
Yeah, when you see some of the faces that Colin pulls, just absolutely roaring with laughter.
Yeah, it's well acted by Tim Roth. I mean, what was he, about 19 maybe in the film?
Yeah, at least something like
that. He wouldn't have been very old at all.
I mean, the whole cast, you know, hats off to everybody in that film.
Yeah. And you see Gary Oldman or Coxie, you know, rolling around that old barrel, just whacking it with a stick inside. It's like, I know that part always gets Rob. He always pisses himself laughing.
I know that's one of Rob's favorite
things. Always cracks him up, that does.
Yeah, but that's another part where you can sort of see that sort of, you know, sort of humdrum existence that they live through in that council state. The
disenchanted, buddy.
Disenfranchised. And one of the things the film does that's very successful, it makes you feel like there's no world outside of that council
state. No, that's right. It's basically their world.
Apart from the fact that they travel to, you know, when they go to Auntie Barbara's, it almost feels like they're coming out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, they feel uncomfortable there. They just want to go home.
Yeah, when you watch the film, when you see them come back to the council state, you feel that sense of comfort again.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit hard to explain, but you feel that.
Which is odd, considering you say they feel that sense of comfort, but they're pissed off where they're living. They can't stand it. But by going out and living and not knowing how to, I suppose, conduct themselves in an area that's more posh.
Yeah.
You know,
like they say in the movie, they've been there all their life and that's all they know.
That's all they know, yeah.
And home is home, you know, even though it's not what you'd like it to be, it is home and they know everyone around there like Rusty, you know, that scene when Mark comes out of the Ladbrokes or whatever, he says, I just put a bit of a llama race.
Hey, race him in Egypt.
Nah, you winding me up. I mean, just those little subtle scenes, you know, where he pulls out stuff like that, you know,
You know, one thing I noticed today that I'd never picked up on before was when they had the maintenance guy come around and he was going into the bedroom of Colin and Mark.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it's a bit small for two guys. It just sort of clicked to me. Did you get the feeling that they were going to demolish the building?
I remember this is the first time I've noticed there was that scaffolding outside the window.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
I'd seen it, but not sort of registered it.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd noticed, the scaffolding. So I didn't – that scene kind of washes over me. Sometimes I have to admit when I watch the film, that scene I sort of tune off a bit.
It's because so much happens in the first, say, 45 minutes to hour, to the first hour, that by the time that part comes around, about an hour and 20 minutes into it, or about an hour and 10 minutes into it, or whatever it is, like something like that, you've just, laughed yourself silly at all the things, or we have anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the more sort of serious scenes in the movie, so you kind of...
Yeah, it's probably the one I've seen the least, the sticks with me the least, I should say.
Probably that exchange between Auntie Barbara and that guy.
Yeah.
It gets a bit irritating because Auntie Barbara's a bit of a...
Yeah.
She thinks she's a bit of a know-it-all.
And he's just like a hippie.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he comes across as a bit of a hippie type or a...
Yeah, he won't sit, he doesn't like chairs, and it's like, yeah, okay, no worries.
But that's another thing in the film. I think it wasn't... How old was I? I was about 12 before we finally had our own separate bedrooms.
Mm.
So that's another part in the movie where, another thing in the movie you sort of associate with, or we can associate with,
yeah,
is that sharing the bedroom, although our bedroom wasn't as bad as theirs.
No, God, no.
You know, you're there each day in the same bedroom. And
we had bunks, didn't we?
Oh, so yeah, we had bunks for a while, then at times we separated.
Oh, did we? Oh, okay.
Yeah, at various stages. But yeah. I was about... Well, I would have been about 12. You would have been about 14.
Mm.
So, we grew up most of our childhood sharing the same bedroom. So,
yeah.
Some of those scenes in the bedroom, I can associate some of those things as well.
Yeah.
Except we didn't have a Kimwell poster.
Didn't have that Kimwell poster, no. And the floor didn't look like shit either.
And that chest of drawers.
chest of drawers with a fucking drawer missing out of it.
Yeah, but, I don't know much more we can sort of say. The film does have a bit of a crescendo at the end with the...
Yeah, with the whole job that Colin gets, as a painter and decorator. I'm a painter and decorator.
Who's the lucky boy then? Yeah, but the film does have that crescendo at the end where,
It had to build to something, I think.
Yeah, it did. That made the film very... It gave the film the realism because, you can sit there and say, oh, yeah, it was funny between Mark and Frank. But in reality, their life isn't fun,
No, it's not.
There's a lot of – if you look at Frank, he's a very bitter person.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be here, that's for sure. lines like that, you can definitely see he's very bitter about how his life has become. But, for all the exchange of funny dog that goes on, which isn't really meant to be funny, but it is – at the end, we do see that scene where, it comes to a bit of a boil, and I think it all starts with Colin being rebuffed by Haley at her place.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah, you can see he comes back in a different frame of mind, and he's got his,
his coat, his woolly coat, over his head,
and he's very. You can see he's very much down in the dumps by that stage, and even you see just after the big fight, which we'll come to in a moment. Mark sort of gives him a bit of brotherly support.
Yeah.
Brother, what does he say? Full of brotherly love you are.
Yeah.
But, that's an argument at the end. And we do see Colin lash out, don't we?
Yeah, it's about the only time you do in the whole film where you see him actually sort of break out of that sort of shell of his where he's, he has some screaming. Get out of my room!
Yeah, but I think that's more out of a lot of frustration, obviously, that's taking place in his life at that current point. And
was he also that way because he found out that Mark said he was leaving? Do you think that might have sort of been like the straw that broke the camel's back from the?
Yeah, that may have played a part, but I think the whole thing with Haley.
That was sort of the impetus of it.
And I think just throughout the movie, you do notice that, Mavis and Frank talk down to him virtually every time they speak.
Yeah, there's never any sort of real support there, or any sort of encouragement of any type.
Yeah, you can see that with both of them, in a sad sort of way that you can see both brothers are very sort of downtrodden in a sense. Like their self esteem is obviously not there, And I think Mark's sort of masking of that is with his, his humour and his wit.
It's a shield.
Yeah, it's a shield. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do get that impression, and towards in the film you do see the the facade sort of break, especially that scene when, you know, the other get Colin on the bed and Mark lashes out and, you know, and then Colin, you know, explodes. So, I mean, you do see that, and it's a very poignant part of the film, I reckon. It's the
part of the film that we had to have at the end, because it was in the middle. It wouldn't have made no sense, because then towards the end, what are you going to do? And it wasn't also overly... It didn't get to a point where you know, all the family start hugging each other. You think, this is not right, because they're not like that.
Leave them. Let them steward their own juices.
Leave them. Let them steward their own juice.
And then what makes it sort of really work is, you know, the next day it sort of, you know, it sort of washes over, and then it reverts back to the
just another day again.
It's back to the, you know, the normal existence that they have, you know. When Mark gets up and he goes, get him out of bed yourself or something like that.
Go get him yourself. Yeah. Go take a look at yourself, yeah.
Yeah. So there is that sort of thing where it, you know, reaches its peak and then it sort of just comes back down
and it starts all over again.
Yeah, and that's when the credits sort of roll. But, yeah, like you said, it did need that part at the end, I think, to sort of give it some kind of validity.
Just so it wouldn't be like a flat line all the way through where nothing happened, okay, and that's the part that everyone remembers, and it flat lines again.
That's on the one side, and then on the other side we've got the part where Auntie Barbara and John have it out. Because did you find that was she kind of suspecting he was having an affair or something?
Yeah, it seems like it.
Yeah, that's the impression I got. But there's not
that would have come back from Mark going, doesn't Uncle John love Auntie Barbara anymore?
Yeah, maybe there's more to it than, you know, maybe there's something going on that doesn't really get brought up in the film.
It's like, the old office romance they say happens. And I mean, there was nothing in the film to sort of warrant her thinking that. There was no...
But you could see even at the beginning when, after the Pollocks leave and they're in, getting ready to go to bed, and it's clear that John doesn't like her side of the family, and she doesn't like his, you know, sort of...
his boss
and her wife and all that.
A fat wife.
I thought she could taste it the way she shoves it down the throat. Yeah. We can't get. What does he say? The Gillespies? At least the Gillespies aren't rude when they come here.
Can't give them chops. They have chops any time.
and that part when, you know, John calls Colin retarded, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you can see she resents him for... He's sort of, I suppose you could say, snobbery.
Yeah, he's just looking down on him.
Yeah, he's not so much looking down on him, but he's just a snob, and, you know, he sees her family as, you know, just trash.
There's not a lot of Alfred Molina in this film, is there? There's only three scenes, the start, and then there's just a small brief appearance where he's in bed reading a book and talking to her, and then towards the end, that's it.
Yeah, he's in a sort of small role, but it's there, and
it's an important one, but it's important one for the content of what goes on in the film. But he's not in the film a great deal,
so
10 minutes or less, he'd be there.
Yeah, I mean, look, and as I said, we'll just sort of brush over some of the more funnier lines. What have we got here? There's that scene in when Coxie and Colin gate crash Haley's flat where she lives with her mum, but we never see her.
No, never see her. What's the deal with the mum? Because they always keep saying, "Oh, no, mum's not here. What's the deal with them?" And even Mark goes, "Well, she's all right, your mum, isn't she?"
I don't know. She just lives with her mum, but we don't see her. Maybe she.
We don't even know nothing about the mum, the backstory at all.
She lives there, and so they sort of you know, welcome themselves into her place, and then Coxie says, calls Colin, "Right, you're the right tasty geezer, one of the lads.
You're my mate."
Yeah. Looks like a hard nut, doesn't he?
He says, "You're my mate," to Colin. See Colin's eyes light up?
Yeah, I know. See, that's the scene where you see some of those facial expressions.
For sure.
Then he starts talking about his Doc Martens.
Yeah, Doc Martens.
He goes, "You've got to get one of these. You look like a mutton, that. Yeah. And then Colin says, "How much?" "How much for?" He goes, "Doc Martens."
Doc Martens.
Yeah. He goes, "Would say 20 quid. You got 20 quid? Might have. In your dreams, you ain't got 20 pence."
"You're right, you are. I like you. You're a white, tasty geezer. You're my mate. We're mates, aren't we? We're one of the lads. I'm going to get one of these.
Better than that, Fane. Been like a mod in that. Get one of these. A pair of Doc Martens. Looks like an hard nut, doesn't he?
How much?
What?
Doc Martens.
20 quid. You got 20 quid?
Why have?
Well, yeah, in your dreams, you ain't got 20 pence.
I've met a few guys with that London accent where they over-accentuate their TSs.
Yeah.
You know, like instead of, they won't say pence, I'll say pence, you know, that sort of stuff.
And yeah.
So, you know, when he says that, you know, you remind me of a few people. And
I've still got my Doc Martens.
Have you?
Yeah. No, they're not the big lace-ups like Coxie's.
Do you wear them with Uncle John's pyjamas, do you?
Yeah. I've had them since bloody 93. So only 25 years, and they're still perfect condition.
Probably last for a lifetime.
I haven't worn them for years, but I mean, they're there.
There's that scene before they actually go up to Haley's place when Colin walks past and Coxie calls him out. Oi, Pratt, you know, calls him out. He calls him out. And then Colin comes up to him. He's got that heavy Darth Vader breathing. and he bludges a fag off him, bludges a cigarette off him. And gives him the cigarette. And he says, "What, do I lock me ass or something, do I?"
Oi, Pratt. Not fag. What, do I light it on my arse or something? Where are you up to?
Nowhere.
Been playing out?
No.
You talking to me, chewing a brick or gnawing a lamppost? Either way, you lose your teeth.
That heavy breathing, mate, that fucking killed me the first time I saw it.
Yeah, I know. That's...
Oh, what's wrong with this kid?
That's one of the things in the movie it's one of the puzzles, you know, Colin's Darth Vader breathing. I don't know if that was part of the movie or if he just added it himself, but
it could have been. I mean, I think Mike Lee's a sort of filmmaker where he's not that controlling, where it has to be his words and it has to be this way. And it's, you know, if it benefits the film and makes it better, and he doesn't care, he'll just put it in there.
Yeah, like I said, it added to the quirkiness of the whole, you know, the people and the characters, I should say. And
I'm glad this film had unknowns in it, because otherwise...
Yeah, well, Gary Oldman...
Yeah, but then...
Yeah, that's true. They were...
But if you look at this film and you didn't see Gary Oldman's name at the start, say you missed the opening credits, you don't see his name, you'd be hard-pressed to pick him. You'd be hard-pressed to pick Tim Roth.
He was a very convincing skinhead, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
So, no, hats off to all the actors and actresses.
There's not one bad performance in this film. There's not one... I mean, even the annoying maintenance guy, but he serves his purpose of what he does.
No, definitely. You know, some of the characters I find irritating only because of the characters that they play. But as far as actors and actresses go, yeah, they're fantastic. So I guess I don't know if there's much more we can sort of add. I mean, we could sit here and quote every line in the film.
Oh, you pretty much do. We could pick apart every scene, every bloody frame. I reckon in this movie.
We find it funny. If you don't, then excuse us for self-indulging. But like I said, it's one of our guilty pleasures.
It comes back to Rio Bravo as well, where it was cultural differences is what really made me not like Westerns or John Wayne.
Yeah.
And that's not a knock on John Wayne or people who like Westerns. It's just because I'm so far away from that life. That and growing up on those things, whereas Meantime hits a lot closer to home for us.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, even though we're obviously here in Australia and Meantime's a British film, but because of the Commonwealth connection there, and also, as Jules said, having a British father, it just it rings a lot more truer than, say, Westerns do. But, you know, if you like Westerns, you like them. If you don't like Meantime, you don't like it. It's
Can I just give one more funny line before we get to the sort of end of the episode?
Yeah.
Frank calls Mavis Joan of Arc. All right, Joan of Arc, thank you, bloody poop.
Because those lines are spat out in such a way of not so much resentment, but also frustration.
Yeah, a lot of it's out of frustration.
A lot of those lines are spat out in frustration because of just their situation they've got in life and... Yeah, they're always trying to top each other with, always trying to be, you know, the one who's come out on top by, you know, shut up. No, you shut up.
It's yeah. A lot of that goes on, yeah. And the language is so real that, you know, you can't help but find it funny.
Oh, for sure. There's no language in there that, you know, you think, these sort of people wouldn't say it to each other.
Yeah, it's very real and it's...
I mean, even when towards the start there when we were looking, and just after they come back to the count to their house, their council flat, and you're laughing about the ginger nuts, ginger nut biscuits. I'd be like, yeah, that's the sort of thing this family would have there, just like ginger butternut biscuits, ginger nut biscuits, and bottles of HB sauce, and
we shouldn't forget their wonderful cuisine.
Oh God!
Fried the classic Colin's fried egg attempt.
Oh my God! The fried egg attempt. It's just like,
He tries to fry an egg and it doesn't come off so well. Double beans for his dinner. You know that part.
Yeah, I mean it really.
I just ate a really horrible hamburger.
It sort of perpetuates the myth that the Brits have no food culture whatsoever. I'm sure that's not the case these days, and I'm sure they are.
One of my favourite lines when Marcus spits out, I just ate a really horrible hamburger.
I just had a really horrible hamburger.
Serve you right.
One of my favourite lines in the film that he says. I always piss myself off when I hear that.
See, it's a line that means nothing. We don't even see him eating a hamburger, but it just makes you laugh, that's all. I kind of wish there was just one night them just eating like a takeout of chicken Gelfreeze. That would have fucking killed me. But yeah, not to be, but still.
So let's maybe talk about, just before we finish, some of our favourites in the film, like our favourite characters. I asked you, I think last time, who your three favourite characters were. I think we had the same, which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, all the Pollock guys.
Well, I said my favourite character in the film was Mark Pollock.
Yeah.
Second favourite was Frank.
Frank.
Father. And third favourite was Colin. And I think you were pretty much the same, weren't you?
Yeah, I was the same, yeah.
How about your probably least three favourite characters? Not that you didn't like it, but you found them a bit irritating or...
I found Arnie Barber irritating, but that was not because of Marion Bailey's performance. Because of her character, literally.
Yeah, just sometimes she grated.
And then she was meant to be that way as well, you know.
Yeah, well, that's it. She played it very well. Yeah,
I found Alfred Molina irritating. Because that's because he was just a snobby guy. And I think I found the maintenance guy irritating as well. But
I found Mavis pretty irritating at times. You know.
I sort of see what you're saying, but the thing is, I find with Mavis is that she's outnumbered by just men in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's always fending for herself.
Yeah, I get that impression too, yeah.
So, in particular, when she says about the line, I'm the only one who ever does anything around here. That's the thing women always bloody say. You know?
There's that one scene where they're all just lounging all over the sofa, over the couch watching TV. What's that science fiction?
It's Mars, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was a cult. What's it say?
It's cult 45.
Yeah. I thought Mars was red. That's what I thought, yeah.
It's cult 45, isn't it? Where's this meant to be anyway?
Mars, isn't it? That's been red, Mars.
That's what I thought.
What?
Look at that.
What? Always got to be between the sheets, isn't it? Spent half their bleeding lives in bed.
What's the time?
Who cares?
Time you got to watch.
Yeah, all those classic lines that we love dearly, and funny how we both mentioned who we find irritating, but we didn't mention Coxie.
Yeah, Coxie's irritating, but he's
also funny.
Yeah, he's also funny in some bits, and for some bits you just want to kick his fucking head in, you know.
He's a very uncomfortable character at times in the film.
Yeah, and that's what comes out of Gary Oldman, the way he played him. He was very well played. Yeah,
excellent. And I also found Hayley a bit irritating at times.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I would say by irritating we mean not as instantly likable as, say, the Pollock guys. But the thing is, I wouldn't have Hayley removed from the movie.
No, she.
I wouldn't have Coxie out of the movie.
No, of course not.
Every component in there needs to be in there.
Maybe I just find her a bit dislikable because of what she did to Colin at the end.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it did give us, the end bit, which we won't mention. Yeah, you got to watch.
We won't mention that part.
No, but I think we should just wrap it up. If you've got nothing else, and just rate this out of 10.
Yeah, I think we've overcovered it. So if we've gone a bit overboard, just give us that indulgence for tonight, because it's a film.
But I think also as well that this film is not going to be as instantly likable, and by us sort of providing as much information as we can about it, having seen it as many times as we have, and people might say, oh, okay, I heard these guys talk about this, and this is what they're talking about. Instead of watching it without any, cold, without any sort of knowledge about it, and go, I didn't like it.
Mm.
I think it's a film you're either going to like or you're not going to like. I've said it a few times now, but that's the way.
Yeah,
I feel.
And that's a film that is not middling, where you would just go, I've seen it, don't need to see it again. And you instantly forget it, you know.
All right, here's my next, probably one of my last questions for the night, but probably a silly one. What would you give it out of 10?
Oh, it's a 10.
Yeah, I was kind of fiddling with 9 and 10, and I thought,
if you had to get anything less than a 10, I'd be fucking stunned.
No, I'm going
to
give it a 10. It's also just a very sentimental movie for me.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's a 10 for everybody, but for me, it's very sentimental, so therefore it gets a 10.
All right, if you had to eliminate one movie out of your catalogue, would it be Meantime or The Burning?
Oh, well, I mean, I like The Burning, but that's a completely different film.
But I know you like The Burning a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I've got this, most people probably don't know much about me, but I've got this fascination for 70s and 80s movies, because that's where we sort of grew up watching that sort of era. So
you're not fond of stuff for... like newer stuff, are you really?
I've tried to watch newer stuff. I don't know. I can't get into them.
You're the same way with TV shows as well, aren't you?
TV shows. Movies, yeah. There's that sort of range from the 60s, 70s and 80s. Mm. There's a few shows in the 90s that I really like Seinfeld and Frasier, but there's not many.
Do you like Frasier?
Oh, yeah, I love Frasier.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you liked it. I know you like Seinfeld. Yeah. I know that one.
I like Frasier a lot.
Okay.
But my favourite TV shows and movies come out of the 60s, 70s and 80s, and music.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's probably just me being from that.
No, it's a lot of people. You're not unique to that.
I spoke to one of the guys that you used to, I think you still know, but you've done a few podcasts with Greg from Greg and Mortis.
Oh, yeah, Greg and Mortis, yeah.
Yeah, he said the same thing. We chatted once briefly, and he said he loves his 70s and
80s. Oh, he's way into that 70s, 80s slasher stuff.
I think he's born around the same time as, and I think John, who does the podcast with you, is about the same age as us, so
yeah,
we've got that same kind of...
But John's just miserable.
What do you mean miserable?
He's just a miserable troll. He doesn't listen to these anyway, so he's not going
to hear it. Okay, well, you can say what you like, but...
But honestly, I should mention, I was saying about how Americans wouldn't get this film, but like I was telling you, Hunter really likes this film and owns it as well. So there is an appeal. It's not like a complete distance of it where Americans just won't get it. Because he obviously gets it, and he likes it a lot.
I can't see a lot of younger people getting it.
Nah.
But maybe people our age and, you know...
Yeah, but then again, Hunter's about a dozen years younger than me, so he's film savvy, so he's got
to
get it.
Yeah,
you know?
He comes across as a guy who's very open-minded when it comes to watching films.
Yeah.
So he's got that, but most people, I don't know, they, like you said, they'd rather watch The Rock and all that sort of Hollywood garbage that's spewing out these days.
Yeah.
Not everyone can have great taste like Game of Death.
What would you do if they remade Meantime? Would you watch it?
I mean, I'd watch it out of curiosity, but there's no way in hell it's going to be original.
The Rock is Frank Polk.
I mean, who would you have in it? I wouldn't even know where to begin to start.
I would look at the cast. If there was one name in it that bothered me, I'd say, forget it. I'm not watching it. It's too sacred. This film is too sacred for me. It's in my top three of all time, ever.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, ever.
It's in my top, definitely my top 25 movies.
In my top three, easily.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know if about that, but it's definitely my top 20 to 25 films, and it's definitely probably one of my favorite English movies. I can't think of any other English movies I would put above Meantime, so... I mean, this Lock, Stock and Smoking Barrels film, I just find them really...
I enjoy that, but it's no Meantime. I enjoy that. I enjoyed Guy Ritchie's second film, Snatch, but they're not that.
Yeah,
they're more your action orientated stuff that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s. But I mean, they're still funny movies. Don't get me wrong; they're still very British movies.
But they ain't got Mark Pollock in it.
I ain't got Phil Daniels in it. But anyway, getting over to the Blu-ray before we wrap it up. Criterion has released the Blu-ray of it just recently, about the last 2 weeks, I think it was, at the point of time of this recording, and. Yeah, the transfer on is a knockout and well worth your time. So if you are in North America, you can easily purchase this, and we recommend it for sure. If it rolls up on Hulu under their Criterion channel there, give it a watch. If you like it, you know, go buy it. If you don't, well, no big loss. You can at least see you've experienced it and found out what all the fuss was from us, what we've seen this film so many damn times and we'll continue to do so, I think, till we're about to shuffle off this earth.
Until we're out the window like bloody lightning.
Till death comes and takes us like bloody lightning out of the window.
I can never get enough of Frank Pollock. Never.
He's too funny. It's just a shame he never did anything else after this, really.
Jeff Robert. Never seen him or anything else.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he just... acting wasn't his thing, but he was bloody good at it.
Fantastic. Love the glasses as well.
Yeah. Do you notice when he was in bed, he had the glasses by the next to his bedside table?
Yeah. It was out like a light. When playing the punk music.
But, yeah, that's right.
But anyway. But yeah, just the last thing I'd like to say about this film is it's also a very... it's sort of set in that time when we were growing up, so we've got a lot of nostalgia for that as well.
Do you think we would have liked it as much if we didn't have a British father who raised us on all that stuff?
Do you think we wouldn't have liked it as much?
Well, because we didn't have that presence around us of always watching stuff like, you know, Monty Python, and David watch other stuff like The Goodies and all that, and all that British humour that we were raised on, and of course, with him and the way he spoke. And
yeah, I definitely think it's a lot more appealing to us because of our connection with you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We find that, especially the language we find hysterical. Yeah. Some of the you know, the terms and that. So, yeah, I think definitely that plays a big part in
it. It's kind of like the Wog Boy as well. I mean, not as much. I mean, Meantime is far exceeds the Wog. Yeah, because we've got Greek heritage as well from Mum.
Yeah, but... Yeah, but Nick Jenops can go fuck himself.
Oh, yeah, he's sent to a fat-ass Wog these days. I'm saying because we've seen all that stuff as well with, you know, all the... Yeah, I'm just saying, there's that side of it, but Meantime, far.
No, I definitely feel a lot more closer to the
British side. Oh, for sure.
The British side I feel a lot more closer with, so...
Yeah, I mean, because obviously it's the stuff we were raised on with the TV and films, you know. I'd say more so the TV.
Anyway, I suppose we can't go much.
No, we're pretty much done. We hope we've given you some sort of insight into Meantime and why we like it so much, and hopefully made you want to go out and at least watch it, if not go out and buy it. So on that note, we'll wrap it up here over at the MMC. Thanks, Jules, for popping on.
Thanks for having me. Hope I haven't sent you to sleep or anything.
You're all right.
And like I said, if you do get a chance, give this film a watch.
Give it a watch for sure, and... you can come back another time in the next little while, and we'll do the Italian Stallion. The film Stallone doesn't want you to see.
Hey, that's in my top three Sylvester Stallone movies of all time.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of Stallone's greatest films. Definitely one of his greatest films.
It's his best film, and it's Daniel Craig's best film.
I'll definitely come back for that one, yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely do a Teddy's Tale on the big screen, yeah. Anyway, so catch us at the usual haunts, midnightmoviecowboys.com, over on social media on Facebook there. We've got a page there and a group there. Email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com if you want to have some show suggestions, if you want to throw some our way. And don't forget the donation pack that's coming. It is being done. If you donate to us on the website, $15 or more, we'll get you automatically lined up for the donation pack to be sent your way. If you only want to donate 5 or 10 or whatever, it's up to you, but 15 will qualify for the donation. And that's that. So, all right, cheers, Jules, for coming in. And
my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, we had fun watching Meantime again. And I'll say, in the immortal words of Hunter, adios.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.